Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of State. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host this evening for the Gist of Freedom, coming to you over the World Wide Web. I want to remind you that these programs are archived and available for free at iTunes at www.blackhistoryuniversity.com.
Hello, this is Joseph Haynes Davis. This is Leslie Gist. I am more than enthusiastic about having you on the show. You have an extensive bio. Could you give us a little snippet of your
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host here in Kansas City for this program tonight on the Gist of Freedom. Excuse me, getting over a little bit of a cold here. Tonight my guest is Earl DePass, who will be talking to us about black whalers. And
yes, good evening.
Hello, Mr. DePass. How are you today?
Yes, good evening. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for joining us. Now, do I understand that you are a descendant of black whalers?
Yes. My great-grandfather was a whaler. He was born in the Canary Islands. And by working on the sail ship, when the ships came to port in Rhode Island, he jumped ship and settled in Providence and eventually married a woman from South Carolina who was a domestic, and those were my great-grandparents.
Okay. Fill our listeners in on how that came about, that blacks got involved in the whaling business.
Yeah, well, I mean, my grandfather, I was raised by my grandparents.
Okay.
And my grandfather was born in 1916 in Providence, Rhode Island. And unfortunately, he lost, his mother died first when he was about 12, and then he lost his father, who was a seaman, at 14. So he knew his father was a seaman. He knew his father was from the Canary Islands. But he actually had little memory of that life, because by the time my grandfather was born, my great grandfather had changed his profession. Seafaring, working on whaling ships, the mortality rate was the only profession during that time that had a higher mortality rate. We're talking about in the late 1800s. Was mining, second only to mining. Whaling was the second most dangerous profession. So as soon as he had the opportunity to get a job working in a jewelry factory in Providence, he took advantage of that position, and he worked as a jeweler, up until his untimely death. But so a lot of the research was actually done when I was a teenager and young adult, you know, my one of the big mysteries in my family, you know, history was my great grandfather. I mean, I have family from the South, from Albany, Georgia, from Chester, South Carolina. I mean, it's just being born in America, the census records, you know. And then I also have Caribbean heritage, which also are from St. Croix and Jamaica. But, you know, that information is much more widely available, you know, in terms of from the knowledge transfer from one generation to the other, and also just in terms of the ability to do research. But, being the fact that this was my grandfather's father, the man who raised me, you know, and the fact there was we really hit a wall with his story. So just out of curiosity, you know, I was able to get some census records. When my great aunt, this is his daughter, okay, his name is William Jones. He had a son named after him, William Jones, and a daughter named Beatrice Jones. And when my great aunt passed, this is my grandfather, I actually got to meet a woman who was, she was almost 100 years old, who actually knew my great-grandfather. And she told me a little more about him, the fact that he was a deacon in the local Black Baptist church. Just general curiosity to find out how did this guy get from the Canary Islands to Providence. Now, I don't know if you know a lot about New England, that the area and Black history in New England. But I mean, obviously there were indigenous African American populations there, but there were also subsequently large amounts of immigrants that came in from the former Portuguese West African colonies. So you had Cape Verde, you had the Azores, and you had the Canary Islands, which was actually those were Spanish possessions. They still are Spanish possessions. But the whaling ships, when they would go into the Atlantic, and by that time the whaling ships were steam powered. And so because that was almost like a midpoint between West Africa and the U.S., it would be a place where they would go and get provisions. They would pick up coal for steam. So it was, those were popular stops for the American whaling ships from New England. So there was a great opportunity for Africans, particularly West Africans, to work on the ships. And, you know, when those ships would come into port, you know, just like any other immigrant during that time, you know,
yeah,
America was seen as, you know, the land of opportunity, you know. So he was actually an immigrant. He was not a African American.
Were there any African Americans involved in the whaling business?
Sure. Actually, from 1800 to 1860, about a quarter of all of the whalers were actually African American. And initially, again, you know, we have a romantic view of being a seaman and being a whaler today. But again, it was a very dangerous job. And to be honest, the Europeans, they didn't want the job. It was very difficult to get Irish and Italians to do that work because the mortality rate was so high. But in the 1800s, you had a number of escaped slaves who would find their way up north. And I guess if you compare working on a slave plantation, you know, even working on a whaling ship would be an opportunity, you know. So during the early stages, I would say between 1800 and 1860, about a quarter of all of the people who worked as whalers were indigenous African Americans. So these were people who were the descendants of slaves brought to, the Americans. But as time progressed, even they got picky in terms of their work, and they would rather work, you know, on land, particularly in New England. You know, the states in the North. Obviously, they had many of them had started to had abolished slavery by the 1830s, 1840s. You know, because you know in the early days, even the Northern states was was slaveholding states. Massachusetts, I mean, New York was at one time. In the early American history, the largest slaveholding state, but obviously they were the first, to abolish slavery. And then they were, so there were opportunities that were safer, that provided a steady income. You know, and people can have families. You know, if you were a seaman, you'd be out for maybe it could be away for as long as a year, maybe even longer sometime. So, I mean, you know, that wasn't the type of job where you could very easily have a family, you know. So when opportunities came about, whether you were working as domestics, as butlers, working, building roads, building subways, you know, whatever, African-American, that was actually a step off in terms of employment. So then at the end of 1860, because there was a, they couldn't find enough Black Americans to do the work. By traveling to West Africa to refuel their ships, they had came into contact with a lot of, Africans who were willing to do that work.
Earl, can I interrupt you there a minute?
Yeah.
The things you've mentioned here, being from South Carolina. It might interest you to know that our producers, Leslie Gist, her family is from Chester, South Carolina.
Wow.
Okay. And I want our readers or listeners to be aware that in 1853, there was an African-American shipwright by the name of John Mayshaw. And he was born into slavery into South Carolina, got himself freed in 1815, made his way to New England, and went on to become a well-known and respected shipbuilder. And he designed more than 100 ships.
Wow.
And he built around 60. And of those 60, 14 were whale ships. I think one was called the Gyros Swift. A lot of them found their way into Australian waters. Obviously drawn to the abundance of whales along the coast. And a lot of trading opportunities there as well.
Well, that's fascinating. Yeah, there were quite a few. I know Absalom Boston, he was a whaler, and he, and this is in Nantucket, and he was a whaling captain. And he was very successful. He built churches. He built inns. He built schools. So yeah, there were quite a few African Americans who, and not to mention you're talking about inventions. I know a lot of the implements. I mean, I went to the whaling museum. There's a wonderful whaling museum in Nantucket. There's also one in New Bedford if you can ever get the opportunity to go. And there were a large number of the blacksmiths. What happened was, as the Black Americans, there were other opportunities, so a lot of them became blacksmiths, and they developed a lot of the technology. You know, we don't necessarily think of whaling as, but if you harpoons, and that was high tech for that period of time, and African Americans were shipbuilding, of course, and that was high tech stuff. We think of particularly steamships, that was the dawn of the steamships, and that was steam engines. That was high tech industry,
Yeah, Earl, can you share with our listeners the connection between Paul Cuffey and the abolitionist connection?
Yeah, well, I do know that a number of the folks involved in the abolitionist movement. I'm not a scholar, but I do know a number of them were former seamen and captains, and the money that they made, whether it was through whaling, through shipbuilding, they used to build middle class freed black societies, and they helped with they participated in the Underground Railroad, the abolitionist movement, and some of them actually even I know even had something that had to do with also transport to Liberia. I know when there was a movement to settle back in West Africa. So a lot of the I always follow the money. You can still do that even in our history, you know, always follow the money. And so a lot of these people were also business people. And a lot of them, you know, they built the churches, the old African Methodist Episcopal Church. A lot of the founding members of those churches that were very active in the abolitionist movement, the Underground Railroad, were former seamen and captains. Many of them owned their own ships.
And you mentioned that a lot of people, that others didn't want to do the job. Could it be that others couldn't do the job and that those Africans and African Americans were very well equipped in terms of strength and the ability?
Yeah, you know, see, this is why this is why I'm tempted. See, they like to focus on our physical skills, but I know for a fact, particularly during, for example, in the early days, even during the early days of slavery, in terms of growing rice, if you look at some of the early slave, they would look for slaves from particular areas in Africa. They also wanted us for our skills, and I mean obviously physically many of us were in were great physical specimens, but I think the thing that is not really discussed a lot is how important our skills were. Our skills as blacksmiths, our skills as builders, our skills as agricultural skills that we had. And to be a seaman, it required a lot of, there was a lot of math required. You had to know how to navigate. You had to know how to rig and tie knots. These were very skilled professions. So I would kind of disagree with you. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't take a lot of physical skill. Of course it does, if you're whaling. But I think the mental and the training that was required was something that also made us attractive. I mean, a lot of African Americans have been working, as you know, you mentioned shipbuilding. And these are highly skilled professions, and I think the thing that gave us the opportunity was, even though it was highly skilled, it was very dangerous. And so, if you were an Irishman or an Italian, and you could work as a firefighter, if you could work on land, they had unions, they had certain advantages. So those are the jobs that they took. But those jobs, to be a seaman, required as much mental agility as physical agility, if not more.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Earl, and I appreciate your bringing that to my attention, in addition to the attention of our listeners, in terms of the intellectual skills that were required to do that work. Speaking of Paul Cuffy, Paul Cuffy was also an owner of ships as well, was he not?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was. He was. Again, all throughout from New England as far south as Philadelphia, there were a number of free black societies. And again, the seed money for a lot of those societies, churches, the bulk of the seed money that came from sea-related professions, whether it was shipbuilding, whaling, whether it's He owned a fleet of ships. A huge amount of that seed money to build all of those institutions, you know, came from seafaring men. And Paul Cuffey was probably one of the most prominent of those men.
You mentioned one of those skills as blacksmithing. Let me share with you and the listeners a piece here. A gentleman by the name of Lewis Temple, who was born into slavery in 1800, was responsible for changing the whaling industry in the early 19th century. And what he did was improve the usefulness of the whaling harpoon, which came to be known as Temple's toggle.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mr. Temple
was familiar with that, yes.
And he would double the amount of production in the whaling industry, and that was his invention.
He made one boo-boo, though.
Uh-oh.
You know what that was? He never obtained a patent.
Ah, yeah.
So, unfortunately, but yes, again, I mean, a lot of the innovations, and I like to call it, it was technology, you know. A lot
yes.
of those technological innovations. And those are the stories that I think people need to hear, you know, because they're familiar with us doing the menial labor. And I don't mean to detract from our ancestors who were involved in that, because that was equally important too. But we were also involved in a lot of the technological breakthroughs. I mean, till up to the current day. But they don't tell the stories you don't hear the stories of the black intellect. You hear the story of the black worker, the black athlete, but not the black intellect.
Exactly.
So I'm so glad that you mentioned Temple and the harpoons that he designed.
Are you collecting any artifacts associated with the whaling industry?
You know, I wish I had the money to. It's actually a pretty active hobby. And a lot of the great stuff are in a lot of the museums scattered throughout New England. I've got four kids. My oldest will be starting college. So basically, I go to the museums and I appreciate it from afar. I mean, I would love to be able to collect, whaling, but they're actually pretty hard to come by because collectors, they're pretty sought after items. Perhaps one day when I have more disposable income, that would be a nice hobby.
And these museums that you're speaking of, are most of those in the New England area, New Bedford?
Yes, many are in New England, but, I mean, there are exceptions. I mean, there's some in San Francisco and the West Coast also because my knowledge is because I'm a New Yorker and I have ancestry in New England. My knowledge is more, but a lot of those black seamen actually helped to settle the West Coast because there were Pacific waters that were full. You know, a lot of the Atlantic waters were over. You know, they were over whaled, so the whale populations in many places were depleted. So when the early Americans had access to the Pacific coast. From Russia to Japan, all of that whole Pacific, there were huge whale populations that were hunted, so there were African Americans from New England with roots in New England who actually helped to settle coastal cities in Northern California and even further north. In Washington State, and a lot of them had roots in New England.
Do you have the names and locations of any of your favorite museums for these children that might be listening out there?
I would recommend the Whaling Museum in Nantucket. There are a number in Boston. There are also a number of African American heritage societies. My grandfather's from Providence, and so you know Brown University, and I'm sure you know the history of the founder of Brown University. I mean, he basically made his wealth came from the slave trade, and with that he built Brown University. But there's also a very active African American historical societies. And basically any black historical society in New England, again, the base is the whaling industry, because that's where all of these entrepreneurs, so that's how they were able to build schools, how they were able to build churches, how they were able to help build the Underground Railroad and help slaves escape to the north. So there are a number of them, so I'd recommend you just go online, but I know Brown in particular has a huge archive, and it's open to the public. They have tours actually, So I don't know. I know the show is based in Kansas City.
Well, no, I'm in Kansas City. Our producer is in New Jersey area. But let me ask you, Hempstead, New York, are you aware of...
Sure, Sag Harbor. The Sag Harbor area, yes, the Sag Harbor area, which is part of Long Island, initially it was the true pioneers in American whaling, we have to always start with the Native Americans. And there were significant Native American whalers all throughout, of course, New England, but since we're talking about Long Island, all throughout Long Island. And as always, wherever you had Native Americans, there was always a close relationship between Native Americans and Africans, and as a matter of fact, a lot of the tribes, I hate to use the word tribe, but a lot of the Native American ethnic groups all throughout the New England and the East Coast, if you go to any of their reservations and you meet them, a lot of them have more African American blood than Native American blood. I mean, you see them. I mean, if you can go, Long Island is the Shinnecock Reservation, and so over time, there was a huge intermarriage, and also with the intermarriage, there was a transfer of skills. So a lot of those Native American whalers transferred their skills to African Americans, and you also had a significant amount of African Americans. Quite frankly, we all know what happened to Native Americans. Oftentimes the African American population became larger than the Native American population, and that's definitely what happened out in Sag Harbor. And again, seafaring people, the profession, they were able to build a stable middle class. I mean, there was a time, and there's still a population. There's still now a lot of prominent, affluent African Americans have, summer homes out in Sag Harbor. But a lot of the reason, the way that started was the indigenous black middle class. A lot of them have Native American blood in them. They built the homes, and they built churches, and so there's a population. In Hempstead, unfortunately, that a lot of the descendants. That area is hot in terms of real estate, and a lot of them, many have sold. They have prime beachfront property there. The money is many of them have actually sold, and some are fighting, are still fighting, the realtors and the people who want to gentrify. That's going on. Okay. So, yes, but that history is still very much alive, and it's very closely intertwined with the Native American, the small Native American population there.
Yeah, a number of those tribes have recently been federally recognized and have a very strong African-American presence. Can you tell us about Pyrus Conser of Southampton Village, who was an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I don't know much about I'm much more familiar with the New England history. And it's funny, I grew up in Brooklyn. And so I was much closer to Sag Harbor and to that Hempstead population, but I really don't have the information about Hempstead and Long Island as much information as I have with the New England populations, but I'm sure you do, and I'd like to.
The information that I'm coming across in reference to, he was an entrepreneur. He led a seafaring life, died at the age of 84.
Wow.
And he was something of a celebrity there in his community of Southampton.
Hmm.
And he worked on a whale ship called the Manhattan. It was captained by Mercator Cooper, and apparently they made history in 1848. You know, foreigners at that time were forbidden to enter Japan, but Captain Cooper, after rescuing the crews of two shipwrecked Japanese vessels, and he was determined to return them to their country.
Wow, what a fascinating story.
Yeah.
Has there been a book written?
Now, that I'm not sure. I will certainly make an attempt here to find that out for you before we go off the air. This gentrify, you mentioned something about gentrification.
Sag Harbor, you know, it's funny. Sag Harbor.
Now, where is Sag Harbor? Where is Sag
that's
Harbor?
On the, that's on the very eastern end of Long Island, Suffolk County, and it's where all the celebrities. I mean, people like Steven Spielberg. You know, a lot of famous. There's a lot of money out there. And even though there were affluent African Americans there, former mayor David Dinkins, Percy Sutton, there were a number of also prominent African Americans who used to, you know, during the summer, they had summer homes out there. But I guess money is affluence is relative, and African American millionaires who are competing with white multimillionaires and billionaires, you know. So,
okay.
And it's one of the, and that area was one of the few undeveloped areas, and I mean undeveloped. I mean in terms of the level of, you know, it didn't have things like chateaus, you know. So a lot of them, I mean, nobody's forcing, I guess, you know, it's funny with gentrification. It's not like you're being forced out, you know, nobody's forcing you out. People offer huge sums of money to buy your land and I guess everyone, you know, and people go.
Oh yeah, money
Hello?
Talks and we know it's best. Now,
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I don't know. There may be someone.
Daddy?
On,
sure.
Get off the phone, please. I'm sorry.
Caller?
Daddy?
Hello? Is that your phone or my phone?
I don't know.
Hello?
We may have a caller.
Daddy?
Yeah, hold on.
Daddy?
Who's this? Could you please hang up, doll?
What?
Yeah, I think that's on your end.
Yeah, hold on. I have a bunch full of visiting children here. Could you hang up, doll, please?
This
is Uncle Earl.
Uncle Earl?
Yes, could you please hang up? I'm on the phone.
Oh.
It's always
sorry
closed.
About that.
That's okay, Earl.
Huh?
That's okay.
I'm sorry about that.
Before we get off the air, and you mentioned books, do you have any books or movies that you could recommend to our listeners?
Oh, well, you know, I say let's start with the classic Moby Dick, right?
Okay.
I mean, we all know the story of Ahab, but when you look at his crew, actually, there wasn't an African American on the ship, but there was a Cape Verdean, and which would have been about the right time, because as I had mentioned earlier, by about 1860, blacks have moved from being the workers on the ships to either owning the ships or owning fleets of ships, building ships, to finding other opportunities. But I always like to start with Cannon, because quite often in the American canon, we still play significant roles in a lot of those stories. So I highly recommend, if they haven't, hopefully everyone has read Moby Dick. And when you read that book, I mean, any romance about living and working on a whaling ship, you would be dismissed really, really quickly. But one of the prominent crew members was a black Cape Verdean. If you want to do further study, I had a list just open, and as I was talking, my page closed. Give me 1 second. Okay. I apologize. But if you go to the Whaling Museum in Nantucket, on their website, hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's actually a section pertaining specifically to the African contribution to the whaling industry, and there's a pretty extensive bibliography there. And that was the web page that I had open that I was going to read from, but I just lost it. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. And just before we go, seeing that you have a great grasp of this whaling industry and the blacks that were involved in it, and would you like to, a couple of questions? Would you like to make a movie relative to the blacks' involvement in the whaling industry, and also give us your take on some of the recent black slavery films here lately, such as 12 Years a Slave, The Help, which wasn't so much about slavery, but post-slavery, also The Butler, Django, the film about Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that?
Well, in terms of a movie specifically about whaling, that story that you told me, that you enlightened me to, about the sailor who was one of the first who rescued the Japanese seamen and returned them Japan when, you know, Japan was not open. To me,
exactly.
That would be a fantastic movie. I mean, that would be a fan. I mean, that to me, that would be, you know, everybody talks about Marco Polo, you know, going to Japan. But to me, in terms of American history, that would be fascinating. I mean, I've never, as soon as I get off the phone, actually, I'm curious to find more about that story.
Okay,
and in terms of the,
you,
okay,
let
sure.
me, before you go into that, let me give you the spelling. I know you're a researcher, and the spelling is important. That ship was captained by a gentleman, Mercator, and his last name was Cooper.
Michael Cooper. I'm definitely going to. What a wonderful story! Yep, I see it already. Yep, the first formal American to visit Tokyo. Unbelievable!
Right.
Now imagine that. Imagine that being turned into a movie.
Wow! There it is.
Unbelievable. I mean, that story is unbelievable. But in terms of the slew of movies, I've seen them all. I mean, I think also we should also mention some of the real pioneering movies. I mean, pioneering movies. I'm not talking about Roots. Roots was great. Don't get me wrong. for its time. But there were movies like Sankofa that didn't get the wide Hollywood distribution and play. And it was an independent film. It wasn't even a Hollywood film. And so, of course, didn't have the budget or whatever. But their cast, I tell everyone to start off with Sankofa by an Ethiopian, actually. Haile, what's his last name, Jeremy. But it has Muna Baruka in it. It's a great international cast. So you have cast from Ghana, cast from Jamaica, African Americans. To me that was the movie before Django. Django was an interesting movie in its own right. Don't get me wrong, but to me that was the Django before Django. I don't know. Have you seen Sankofa?
No, I have not. I'm writing it down.
Yes, Sankofa, and it was about a model, an African American. She was modeling nude modeling in Almina Castle, okay, in the slave. So imagine a black American modeling swimwear in the slave castle, defaming the castle. So one of the locals saw that, and somehow she gets magically transported back to a plantation. And you can kind of guess what happens after that. A great movie. But the recent slew of movies, I must say, I've enjoyed them because they've been they're all over the place. I mean, Django, which is really a fantasy, but it was great. There's very very little historical accuracy in a movie like Django. So I don't want to even put it in that class of movies in terms of historical accuracy. There's much more historical accuracy in 12 Years a Slave. But nonetheless, I mean, I enjoyed the movie. It was nice to see basically see the black guy win, you know, and run off in the sunset. Now we know there's no way in hell that would have happened. You know, but it was interesting, and perhaps it took a white guy, it took a Quentin Tarantino to write a movie like that, because it's really a western, a fantasy western set in the South. But I enjoyed it. I must say, I did enjoy that movie. But 12 Years a Slave, I think that was a well done movie. The ending, I think they wrapped the ending up too soon. After seeing the movie, I read the book and did a little bit of research on the history. It wasn't like the white guy, after he told the white guy where he was, that they came and released him. No, it took months to negotiate. There were courts involved. He was actually on that plantation under that crazy slave owner, negotiating his freedom to get up north. So I think if they would have put that story, he must have been, I'm afraid, to, assuming his owner was anything like the character that was portrayed in the movie. I mean, here's a guy, you got a guy that you paid for, a slave, and he's proven that he was illegally captured and sold into slavery. You hate this guy, but now he's got the law, quote unquote, on his side, and he's still living on the plantation. And the other slaves are seeing this. Those months waiting for him to actually get the paperwork done so he can return to the North must have been hell. And I think if that was portrayed in the movie, that would have made the movie even better. You know, than it was. Because in the movie, you've seen the movie, right?
Actually, I have not.
Oh, well, I don't want to give it away. But they tidy it up too easily in the movie, okay? I don't want to give them. You should definitely go see the movie. So basically, once he does, he's freed. But it's like he's freed, and the next day he's back with his family. you know, in the north. It didn't really happen like that in real life.
Right.
So, it was a well done. I mean, that's my one critique of the movie. But it was a well done movie. Again, having African, there were a significant number of there was particularly an actress she played a slave. Having a cast that includes, native-born Africans, I think really helps the authenticity, you know, of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think Roots, for example, in the beginning of the series where you got like O.J. Simpson, you know, in Africa, and I'm married to a West African, so I'm pretty familiar with the culture. And as much as good as Roots is, and I still think it's a wonderful story for its time, but the early, you know, where they have Cicely Tyson, and that the scenery, it's just, I think if they would have had African actors, and I think it would have been stronger early on in Roots. Because if you look at Sankofa, and if you look at 12 Years of Slaves, the best supporting actors were all African. They just brought a level of authenticity, you know, to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, so the slower movies has been, I must say, that they've been, specifically Django and 12 Years of Slave, very different movies. One is more fantasy.
Let me make a comment on that Django, and I think you're right about that specific movie. But there were examples. For example, there were black men with Brown on his raid at Harper's Ferry, who
right.
were going in three blacks. There
right.
were abolitionists, particularly in the East, Philadelphia, who were banging in doors in courtrooms, physically taking blacks who had been captured due to the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, returning
right.
them freedom, sending them on up to
right.
Canada. A lot of
right.
that included a lot of gunplay.
Right. But the thing is, Django was an indefeatable. If Django had a posse, then it might be a little more believable. But Django was basically an individual. I mean, he did have one, the German guy. He did have one helper, but it's like a Western, in that he's the sole guy who's doing all of this, you know, and that just wasn't going to happen, particularly in the Deep South. This is happening in the Deep South. And, I mean, it's a wonderful story, but it's a fantasy, you know.
Yeah,
and so I enjoy it as a fantasy, you know? It's a fantasy, you know? It's not historical. That's what I'm, you know, that's my, but I enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed it. And Samuel L. Jackson playing the Uncle Tom, unbelievable. Oh, he played that role, unbelievable. He stole the movie, really.
Yeah, Earl, we're about ready to get off the air. We're about out of time here. Contact information. If our listeners want to get a hold of you, do you have a web page?
No. Again, I'm not a professional historian. I'm just an individual. And in terms of Facebook, believe it or not, I'm a IT professional. And I don't have a Facebook page, believe it, because I have issues with their respect to privacy.
I got you.
So I'm here as a novice. I want to stress this to your listeners that I'm an average guy and that you can do the same thing that I'm doing.
You're a genealogist, right?
No. I'm just an average guy who has interest in my family's history, and I use Ancestry.com. I visit, you know, I have kids. I visit museums. I do a lot of. I'm an avid reader. I am in no way a professional genealogist, historian. I'm a guy with a bachelor's degree. I have an IT business. So this is, I'm an average, regular guy. So I want to stress to your listeners that, you know, that if you have a passion for something, like I have a passion for my family's history, and I have a passion for history in general. I just love reading. You can, you know, you can pursue your interests and have some knowledge, you know, on in historical areas, you know.
Thanks,
so, yeah, so now I'm just a regular guy. No PhD behind my title.
Well, it's been very enlightening speaking with you and hearing what you do know about black whalers. For our listeners, my guest has been Earl DeCass, who's been talking to us about the black whaling and black whalers in that industry and the African Americans, West Indians, et cetera, involved in that trade. We're going to have to say goodnight. This has been the Gifts to Freedom, and our producer is Leslie Gist, G-I-S-T. And if you should want to get a hold of her, you can do that at leslie@thegiftoffreedom.com. I've been your host, Preston Washington. And right now I want to again thank Earl for joining us and bid him a good night in addition to our listeners. Good night, everybody.
Good night and happy Kwanzaa.
Yeah, you too.
All right.